Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Quentin Tarantino, the pop culture alchemist. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 24 minutes. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World. The aisles are narrow, the carpet is tired, and the clamshell cases stare back with sun-bleached covers. Kung Fu imports and biker flicks, French noirs with cigarette burns and American programmers whose titles overpromise in a proud, honest way. It smells like plastic and dust and cardboard sleeves. Somewhere in this overstocked chapel of the video era, a clerk who knows the catalog better than he knows his own closet excitedly tells a customer that a forgotten 70s thriller has a tracking shot that will change their life. Our guide is that clerk, and also a director who turned the clerk's gift, feverish memory for other people's pictures, into an art of his own. Quentin Tarantino. He did not simply revive genres, he taught them to argue with their past. He did not simply stage violence, he turned talk into a fuse and let you hear it burn. He did not simply quote, he transformed quotation into authorship. He changes how we see the world by proving that pop memory can be a serious instrument, that suspense can be composed from sentences, and that the past, if treated with mischief and craft, can be convinced to yield futures it once refused. He grew up in Los Angeles and in movie theaters, a child of a city that manufactures dreams for export and rents them to its locals at matinee prices. The story that gets told, and it is mostly true, is that he apprenticed in a video store where taste was an hourly wage and enthusiasm a currency. That job raised a director. The counter taught him to pitch a film in a sentence, the return bin taught him how moods travel, and the shelves gave him the informal graduate degree. Shaw Brothers swordplay and spaghetti western whistles, French policier cool and blaxploitation swagger, B-pictures that always ran 5 minutes long and therefore taught him how to cut air. His classrooms were grindhouses on the boulevard and second-run palaces whose projectors coughed. His teachers were directors he would later smuggle into his frames as ghosts. Truffaut's tenderness hiding in a tough guy's monologue, Lyon's patience in a stare, Godard's chapter headings scribbled on American diners, De Palma's split screens rehearsed in a dead-end hallway, Fuller's bark in the cadence of a story that refuses to be ashamed of its pulp. The first produced script that felt like a declaration was Reservoir Dogs. Six men in black suits, three aliases too many, a warehouse that looks like the inside of a lie, and a heist we never see. The choice not to show the robbery is not coyness, it is instruction. He wants you to learn that aftermath, properly arranged, is richer than spectacle. He starts in a diner with a conversation about a pop song and tips and ethics, and the talk is a test. Can a room hold tension without a gun on the table? It can, if the sentences move like sharks. When the blood arrives, it is noisy and cartoon red because the film isn't pretending to be wallpaper. It is a report about how men weaponize performance. The shot from the trunk, the camera looking up at faces deciding what to do with you, is a grammar note he will reuse. Authority reversed, the audience placed where the victim would be, the scene tilted into complicity. The famous dance to Stuck in the Middle with You produces an argument about the difference between stylization and anesthesia. Tarantino's camera refuses to look when the blade moves close. You hear it, you feel your body argue with your appetite. He exploded on the widescreen with Pulp Fiction, a film that behaves like a desk drawer full of memories you keep meaning to organize and then decide halfway through that the mess is a better record of your life than any neat album. He structures it as a loop, out of order but in rhythm, because he wants to teach continuity with the nerves, not with the calendar. A hitman and his partner arguing about hamburgers and foot massages rehearse an entire philosophy of power. Talk is foreplay, talk is anesthesia, talk is armor. A boxer deciding not to throw a fight becomes a comedy until it becomes a bloodbath and then a romance. A date that should be a crime deters into a resurrection. A holdup in a diner returns to its first sentence to learn better manners. The content is famous: dance floor, adrenaline syringe, gold glow in a briefcase that refuses to become a plot. So is the sound. Surf guitars and soul standards, oldies lovingly stolen back from nostalgia and made present again. The director's real innovation lies deeper. He proved that digression could be structural and that suspense did not require chase scenes if you taught an audience to fear a choice arriving at a table. The most violent moment in the film may be a silence. The one that lands just before a wallet is handed over along with permission to live. He followed with Jackie Brown, and if you were watching his career for proof that the Wunderkind could become an adult, this was your exhibit. The story is Elmore Leonard by way of South Bay, a stewardess supplementing her income, a bail bondsman old enough to wear sadness as a uniform, a gun merchant with a smile too wide to be safe, and a plan that works only if people who don't trust each other can act. He slows the camera and lets middle age carry the frame. Pam Grier's face becomes a promise the movie keeps, and Robert Forster's kindness becomes an argument about masculinity that the cinema had been postponing. The tone is soft without being sentimental. He enjoys the mechanics of money drops and department store choreography, but his heart is busy elsewhere. Two grown UPS acknowledging that their chance is slim and that dignity might sometimes be the best ending art can offer. If pulp taught a decade that coolness can carry intelligence, Jackie Brown taught the same decade that patience can carry romance. Then he split a revenge epic into two volumes and built it like a mixtape. Kill Bill is a director's notebook sprung to life, kung fu schools and Shaw titles, spaghetti twang and Japanese city lights, anime interlude that turns trauma into moving ink, yellow suit that remembers Bruce Lee while insisting on a new owner, whistled tune that makes a corridor into a duel. But for all the references, the film's claim is not trivia, it is choreography. He uses stylization as a firewall to keep exploitation from exploiting again. The fights are ballets that ask the audience to admire craft, not injury. Uma Thurman's Bride carries a purpose that strips away all euphemism. When she fights the crazy 88 in a room that the camera understands from every angle, he photographs the bodies with the fairness a stage owes its dancers. Wide when wide is honest, close when close is earned, cuts placed like beats because rhythm is meaning. He lets the story slow to a whisper in a trailer with a snake and in a kitchen with a child. The woman who had to survive becomes a mother who has to teach. The film's exuberance risks everything, sincerity, goofiness, grandeur, and lands on a statement. Cinema can borrow anything if it returns it repaired. He went from samurai blues to war fiction with the gall of a director who trusts his method. Inglourious Bastard is many films politely stacked, a farmhouse drama that turns milk into terror, a propaganda farce that invites a nation to burn in a theater and then keeps its nerve, a caper in a basement where cards and accents perform more bloodshed than bullets, a fairy tale with boots on, above all, a language exercise disguised as a thriller. He writes in German and French and English and teaches the audience to pay with their ears. The opening chapter is a tutorial in how to build tension with courtesy. A colonel arrives and smiles and compliments a farmer and asks for a glass of milk and never lets the truth out of his hands. The camera shapes the air and the edit waltzes slowly toward a verdict the room has already reached. By the time the flame rolls up a nitrate print, you feel the film's thesis. Cinema cannot reverse history, but it can cure helplessness for 2 hours and 27 minutes, and that relief is not trivial. It is a rehearsal. It might teach you something about your mouth tomorrow. Django Unchained took on slavery with the insolence of a genre mixer who believes that the Western owes debts it never paid. He borrows the hat, the horse, the duel at noon, and installs them in Mississippi mud. The violence is operatic and sometimes cruelly funny, and the humor is a scalpel. It opens a wound that polite historical fiction often bandages too early. He lets a freed man become a gunslinger because dignity is a skill, not a grant. He lets a German bounty hunter teach a student because knowledge is a conspiracy before it is a diploma. He lets a plantation owner talk himself into doom because the language of mastery is a trapdoor. Critics argued over tone. The film earned its stubbornness by making revenge a grammar lesson in a country that mislearned every tense of that verb. If Bastard refitted film history to scream back, The Hateful Eight went in the other direction. Indoors, a storm, a roadshow with overture and intermission, 70mm frames so wide they turn a cabin into a courtroom. He used ultra-panavision lenses to photograph faces at a range they rarely receive. Pores, breath, the animal patience of a liar waiting to find out whether lies will be enough. Ennio Morricone wrote a proper score for the first time on a Tarantino film, and the music does what Morricone's music always does. It dignifies a dirty room with a religion of its own and then refuses to agree with anyone's prayers. The plot is a murder knot, but the film's real labor is a study of voice, how people construct selfhood out of insult, how mercy gets delayed when a room has learned better tricks. Late he went elegiac. Once upon a time, in Hollywood parks itself in 1969 Los Angeles and decides to move no faster than a car radio. A fading TV cowboy and his stunt double drive a city that has not yet been announced as history, and a neighbor, a woman whose name injury taught us too early, drifts through the days that lead to a midnight we all know too well. The film chooses, for once, not to stab the past in the heart but to hold its hand. He reconstructs the neon and the textures and the gossip, the way a theater marquee can turn a random evening into an event and a driveway into a portal. He lets a child actor teach a man to work. He lets a dog perform ethics. He lets friendship, two men who have learned how to use loyalty as a form of shelter, be a plot. And then he reaches the night and refuses to rehearse horror faithfully. The once obligatory carnage becomes a counterfactual that refuses to dignify murderers with permanence. He is accused of nostalgia. The accusation is partly right. Nostalgia is the sugar on his rim. But underneath is a grown man trying to atone for an industry that once turned a tragedy into a brand. What makes his scenes move the way they do is not a secret. It is practice. He writes conversation the way musicians write riffs, motifs introduced and developed, rests placed carefully, tempo changes time to a character's courage. A Tarantino dialogue scene often begins with trivia and ends with a sacrament. A joke about a song becomes the key to a safe. A debate about etiquette becomes a test of mercy. He directs the talk like action, blocking that choreographs who has the floor, framings that put a listener in a position to become an accuser, camera drift that reminds you a third party, us, is always present. The violence often arrives late because the talk is both the cause and the point. He builds suspense with information asymmetry. You know more than one character does, and the gap is the drum. He refuses wallpaper music. The needle drop is an announcement. When Cat People, Putting Out Fire, walks into a projection booth, you understand that the song isn't a soundtrack, it is an accomplice. When Nancy Sinatra introduces a vendetta, the strings do legal work. He is a composer of chapters. Title cards, time jumps, repeated angles, a familiar prop turning up in the wrong film as if the universe were a small town. These are not indulgences, they are memory aids. His cinema trusts you to keep your own notes. He learned from pulp that a pause between installments can heighten appetite. He learned from comic books that a universe is a promise, not a contract. The red apple cigarette pack, the big kahuna burger bag, the radio DJ with a voice that smells like vinyl. Those are not Easter eggs. They are invitations to think of the work as a conversation with itself. He delights in the alternate history, trick not because he wants to win arguments with ghosts but because he wants to return agency to people who, in real life, were denied it. The rescue is symbolic. He knows that. Symbols are not nothing. Editing was, for his first two decades, the second heartbeat under his dialogue. Sally Menke cut his films until her death in 2010, and their partnership shaped the cadence we now call Tarantino. Scenes that end one breath later than comfort and begin one breath earlier than convention, long takes that trust performance enough to abolish flab, smash-ins that treat a cut as a punchline, and slow motion withheld until it can truly break time into a moral. After Menke, Fred Raskin continued the rhythm with respect, and you can hear the continuity. The pause before the basement's first shot rings out in Bastard. The width of the hateful eight frames grants silence a salary. The Hollywood finale cuts like a sigh interrupted. The continuity underlines the point. His style is not a set of ticks, it is a tempo. He is a curator of formats. He loves 35mm and 70mm not only as romance but as ethics. Film print as witness, grain as memory, projection as stewardship. He bought a repertory house and runs prints because his altar is also a classroom. He cherishes mono cues on old records and will build a sound mix around a piece of vinyl as if fidelity were a moral obligation. When he returns to a lens older than some of his actors, it is not the fuss of a collector. It is the faith of a conservator who believes the old glass sees skin with justice. If you are tempted to dismiss him as a DJ with a camera, pause. A DJ is a serious kind of author when they do it right. The choices say who you are, the sequence says what you believe, the silence before the drop is as meaningful as the drop. Tarantino learned that lesson. He does, however, walk into arguments he deserves. He has been accused, sometimes lazily and sometimes precisely, of confusing liberation with language, of using slurs as seasoning, of treating pain as a playground for verve. He has been taken to task for the culture that protected the producer whose company made his early work. He has been criticized for not doing enough soon enough to break with that protection. He was confronted about safety and consent in his stunt work. He listened and made amends where he could. The point of including these shadows is not to injure the films. It is to keep faith with the idea that giants are measured across their whole stride. Tarantino's stride is not one of purity. It is one of undeniable craft and evolving conscience. What does his method give to people who will never write a scene where a colonel asks for strudel and a glass of milk? First, a way to use conversation as action. Most organizations treat talk as a cushion. He treats talk as an engine. Try running an investigation or a hiring round or a design review with Tarantino's rule. The most revealing sentence will be the one that looks like a detour. Frame your meetings so that people have permission to wander, but keep your ear on the verbs. The moment someone describes what they will actually do, cut there. That cut, the edit you apply to your day, will save months of confusion. Second, a lesson in structure as suspense. You can arrange information in chapters so that truth lands when it can be used. In a product launch or a public campaign, do not dump the heist. Withhold the robbery and organize the aftermath so that competing versions of reality have to explain themselves in one room. When the reveal arrives, you will have built an audience capable of recognizing its consequences. Tarantino's loop timelines are not tricks, they are fairness. They give every participant their day in the light. Third, the practice of quotation as responsibility. He samples but not lazily. He clears his samples by transforming them into argument. In any field, research, policy, education, you can borrow so long as you show you're working and improve upon what you took. Give the footnote the dignity of the chorus. Do not steal, curate with credit. He modeled the joy of acknowledging your debts out loud with fireworks. That habit will keep your project honest and recruit unexpected allies. Fourth, tone as instrument. He jokes inside horror and places tenderness next to profanity not to shock but to achieve accuracy. Real rooms contain both. In leadership, use tone deliberately. Allow humor when it is a safety valve. Remove it when it is a weapon. His best scenes keep the laugh risky. That risk is how you keep cruelty from borrowing comedy's passport. Fifth, the power of sound selection. The playlist in his films trains your attention. In your work, choose sounds with the same obedience to meaning. Put a song before a briefing and let it tell people what kind of day they're about to have. If the song lies, choose a different day. In personal life, score your tasks lightly and consciously. One track for cleaning the kitchen, one for writing a difficult message, one for the walk that prevents a fight. The score will teach your body a rhythm you can work with. Sixth, format fidelity as culture. His insistence on film projection is, beneath the nostalgia, a policy. Respect the medium and the medium will repay you in trust. Translate that, respect your tools. Treat your code base, your instruments, your protocols as things to be maintained as well as exploited. Own a small theater in your own profession. Some venue where the old work can be seen in its intended light and the next generation can learn not just content but temperature. Seventh, revisionary imagination. He writes alternate histories not to cheat harm but to balance it, temporarily, with a fantasy that empowers the powerless. In organizations, allow a version of this. Run tabletop exercises where the disenfranchised get the microphone and write the counterfactual policy. Even when you return to reality, the exercise will change the next paragraph you write. An eighth, chaptered accountability. Tarantino's title cards do not let you forget where you are. Design your projects with visible milestones that have names, not numbers. The basement, the projection booth, the trunk shot, labels like those make memory work for you. People will argue less about sequence when the sequence has personality. It is possible to talk around his craft forever and miss the modest, intimate pleasures. The way two characters share a cigarette and invent trust. A glance from a waitress that rearranges a man's afternoon. The dignity of a veteran bail bondsman buying a cassette because music is a way to stand upright. The small mercy of ending a film with friendship where violence might have been cheaper. It is also possible to overexplain. Many of his scenes survive their own essays because they were built correctly. A floor plan that makes sense, a prop where a hand can reach it, a line whose rhythm admits no lies. Watch the farmhouse scene again with the sound low and count the glances. You will learn blocking faster than in some schools. Watch the Kill Bill church rehearsal flashback and notice how he allows daylight to turn a dusty room into a judge. Watch Jackie Brown's shopping mall run. The camera is a cashier who knows everyone by first name and never loses a bill. His legacy includes the decade he accidentally curated, the 90s wave of crime talkers and smart aleck bloodbaths that misunderstood the ratio of heart to swagger in his work. He became a genre people tried to photocopy. Photocopies rarely carry soul. But even the misfires prove influence. He taught a generation of screenwriters that scenes can be built around appetite, of all kinds, and that cool is a tool, not an end. He taught actors that embarrassment is currency. The audience pays more for a truth that costs the performer something. He taught cinematographers that long lenses and low angles and trunk hatches are not gimmicks if they have the good manners to be motivated. He taught editors that patience is not slowness and that a cut is a thesis. He remains, for all the spectacle, a man of sentences. He writes on paper with a pen and reads out loud to actors like a bandleader counting off. He protects rehearsal like a neighborhood. He has the stubbornness of someone who has found a voice and the curiosity of someone who likes other people's records enough to keep flipping through the crate. He will, he says, stop at 10 features as if the career were a chaptered novel with an agreed-upon last page. Perhaps he will. Perhaps he will keep showing prints at the Repertory Theater and arguing about aspect ratios and perfect takes until the argument becomes the work. The point is not the number, the point is the practice. He insists in A Century of Plenty on the artisan's oath. Write it, shoot it, cut it, play it. If it isn't alive, keep your name off it. If all this sounds like a praise song with too little salt, remember the ledger. He is not immune to the vanity that his characters often mistake for destiny. He has used words that burn. He has had to be taught why some jokes aren't. He has needed, like any adult, to convert talent into responsibility and the romance of being movie mad into the discipline of being a citizen among other workers. The conversion is incomplete as conversions are. The films record progress. Greater care with safety, greater care with grief, greater care with how a myth touches a body. The rest of us can learn alongside him or choose the cheaper hobby of tut-tutang. Choose the first. It's more interesting and yields better scenes in your own life. Try one more exercise borrowed from his trunk shot. Place your camera, metaphorical or literal, below the people in the room who usually tilt the angle. Ask them to look down and decide, with their faces fully lit, what they owe whoever is in that trunk this week. Maybe it is a junior colleague. Maybe it is an old promise. Maybe it is a customer whose face you have never actually imagined. Hold the shot. Keep breathing. Let the sentences deliver the verdict. Then cut cleanly to action. You will feel, for a minute, why his cinema turns talk into something that moves the furniture. He changed how we see the world by making quotation a form of honesty, by proving that conversation can be as kinetic as a chase, by reminding an industry that genre is a toolkit, not a prison, by giving a generation permission to be encyclopedic without being pedantic, and by staging revenge without forgetting that survival, finally, is the more complicated art. He is the video store clerk who wouldn't stop recommending and the filmmaker who earned the right to put his own title on the shelf he once dusted. If you walk past that shelf and choose another film, he won't mind. He'll grin and tell you to come back when you're done. There's a scene in the next aisle he can't wait to show you, and he's right. It's a killer. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants Who Changed How We See the World.